Vishus Marina Rav Shlita. I wasn't sure whether to call it Masara and modernity or Masara versus modernity. Certainly the word modern is misconstrued often. We once discussed the fact that the Torah is very up-to-date and modern. Any modern situation can be dealt with a psak from the principles of the Torah. The Torah is always modern. The Torah is always up-to-date. It's heretical to call the Torah old-fashioned. So when we talk about modernity here, we don't really mean that sort of modern, or as some people say, modern. We're talking about present-day challenges which come about and are challenging, basically, Orthodox Judaism. But when we're talking about Masora, we're talking about something a little more than simply halacha, or medrash, or what is written in scripture. Masora is a subject which is alluded to in the very first Mishnah of Perkei Avos, Perek Aleph, Mishnah Aleph, Moshe Kibbol Torah Misinai, U'Masora LeYoshua, and then Yoshua LeZakeinu, Zakeinu Neviim, Neviim Masrua, L'Anshei Knesset HaGdola. So there's an idea there of Masira, of handing over one generation to the next, one Rebbe to the Talmud, and then the Talmud becomes a Rebbe, and then the next Rebbe gives something over the Talmud. The oral law, you might say, but it's something distinctly different to just what is Torah Shebaal Peh. To give an idea of what Masorah is, it's not simply a load of knowledge which we'll pick up from Sforim. It's a process of accessing a chain of teacher-student relationships back to Har Sinai throughout the generations. So it can cover a very broad spectrum of different topics, some of which we will try and cover today. Certainly when there's a dispute or there's a worry about something, we've got the Pasuk Ki Polei in Devarim chapter 17, where you go to the Beis Din, you go for a Psak, you got a Rav. And you can't just Google something in order to get a Psak Din. You can't just tell a computer the answer that you want and then it will pump out who asks that question. That is not Yiddishkeit. Yiddishkeit is keeping to the Masora, which we can treasure in the traditions handed down to us from one generation to the next. And even in the world generally, there are certain things which you can call Masora. The Kuzari says that it's amazing that the whole world adopts a decimal system, that we calculate according to the number 10, right? Simple thing, that all over the world, whatever kind of country it is, communist or otherwise, mathematicians, others, will always calculate according to the number 10, and then when you get to 11, you're starting off your little cycle again, with the 1, 2, 3, etc. That is a Masora, because that is what the whole world does. There's no law about it. And amongst the non-Jews of the world, they all have 7 days in a week. 10 fingers, is that why? Oh, I'm still learning how to count. And even the people who've got nothing to do with the Torah hold that there are 7 days in a week. The idea of having a rest day. There are certain things which are unspoken, but are just done universally. So what is, to give an idea of what Masora really is, my son-in-law and the son-in-law told me a couple of stories. He told me about a bocher who went to Rav Shach and also to the Stipler Gaon with a question. Rav Chaim Shmulevich, the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir, was very ill. And people were saying tilim for him. But he said to Rav Shach, look, it says in the Gemara in Brachos Yud Beis that when a Talmid Chacham is very ill, Tzorech Shiechle, oneself, one should make oneself put out, one should do a Mesiras Nefesh, to do whatever one can. So he said, surely we should close up all the yeshivas for a day and make a Yom Tefillah, we should go daven by the coastal and daven for the life of Rav Chaim Shmulevich. And he asked the same question both to Rav Shach and to the Stipler Gaon. And both of them gave exactly the same answer without being aware that the other one was asked. Both of them said, what you're saying is 100% right according to halacha. According to halacha, you are correct. But it's not Masora. We don't do that. We don't close up the yeshiva for a whole day. But you are right in halacha. Masora has a certain edge to it, which is even stronger than halacha. Something which is in our oral tradition, which is handed down to us. We don't have a Masora for it. And then there may be other things where we do have a Masara for something, yet the rule is not written down anywhere. He told me the story that Rav Basalel Ashkenazi said that when you learn the Sechta Nedarim, as I believe many people are now in Daf Yomi, when you learn the Sechta Nedarim, you don't learn it with the Rashi, you learn it with the Ran. Why? Because many hold, Rav Basalel Ashkenazi wrote, that the Rashi which we have in our text is not genuine Rashi. It was somebody else, maybe Rashi died and somebody carried it on with the name of Rashi. It's a Masorah that it's not Rashi. Nothing controversial about that. Somebody once came along to Rav Aaron Leif Steinman, and asked him, what do you feel about me writing a collection of all different Rashi writings elsewhere, which would apply to those various lines of Nedarim? So that way I can do a Perush Rashi on the Nedarim. Like you get nowadays a sefer which is Rav Hirsch on the Siddur. And what is it? It's a collection of writings throughout Chumash and through Cherev and other Sfarim which Rav Hirsch wrote. And that's his Perush on the Siddur. He didn't necessarily write his Perush on the Siddur, but because he wrote so many other things which relate to the different parts, you can call it a Perush on the Siddur. So in the same way, I'd like to write a Perush of Rashi on the Sechta Nedarim. And Rav Aaron Leib Steinman said, no. He said, in the Dorim, let man the Ran. There is a tradition, there's a Masorah that when you learn Gemara in the Dorim, you learn the Ran. That's a Masorah. There's no written rule about it, but it's something which we have handed down to us. Those two stories encapsulate the idea of what Masorah might really be. And so we're going to try, in the time that we have, to explore certain ideas relating to Kashrus, maybe to Tefillah. We've got the challenges of the feminist movement. These are the ideas of modernity where people come up with their modern day challenges, and we have to ask ourselves, what is the halacha and what has Masorah got to say about it? So people who actually deny Masorah, in the words of Rav Soloveitchik, are called Abikorsim, because the Rambam writes in Hilchas Teshuvah in Perek Gimel, Halacha Ches, various definitions of what a heretic is, and one of them is V'hamakhish Magideho, and he translates that as somebody who is denying the Masorah. And that is the wrong thing. We had the Sadukim, we had the Karaites, and they were claiming that they were holding the true Torah, but they were rejecting the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law, and within that oral law is the Masorah. So we have a hidden weapon. The problem that the non-Jews have in trying to challenging us, in particular the Christians, as we once discussed, is they can't really get into our oral law like they can try and get into our written law. And that is what keeps us going. We had a few months ago a discussion about Techeles, about the blue thread which is worn with tzitzis. And there are many people nowadays who, quite justifiably it seems, have a very strong argument to say that the chilozon which gives the tcheles is a snail called the Murex trunculus. And they've brought loads and loads of proofs, and when you go through them, they're very strong and compelling arguments. And yet, when you look around amongst the Haredi world, nobody's wearing it. Well, some people are wearing it, but very few people are wearing it. And you can imagine that if everybody would start wearing it, what a huge order they'd get for these snails, which you can't manufacture with machines, what a big problem they would have. But the question which we asked in that shiur was, why aren't people saying, wow, this is it, great, we can now wear a blue thread in accordance with what the Torah says, Al Pasil Techeles, Voyolachem Netzitzis. And there are a number of Gedolim who we quoted Rav Eliashiv, Rav Sternbuch, we don't have a Masorah. But the last time Techeles was worn with a Masorah was approximately 2,000 years ago, and then the Jews went into exile and were dispersed, and we lost it, and we just do not have an oral tradition as to what the chilozon is. So however many experiments you can do, and there were, we discussed Rav Herzog's involvement, and there were others, there was Rav Finkelstein, and about the rest, theories as to what the chilozon is, and the discoveries which took place when they went out into the sunlight and realized that this so-called blood of this snail is turning blue in the sun and can provide us with the blue thread of tzitzis. But we don't have a Masorah, and that's why we're not doing it. We don't have a Masara, and that is the strength of Masara. The subject of Masara comes up a lot with Kashrus.
Where's the source of the idea of Masara?
This Mishnah, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Sinai, Masara LeHoshua, and it comes up a lot in the Rishonim, in the expressions. When we discuss Kashrus, Rashi and Chulin uses the words in Gemara Chulin Daf Samach Beis. He talks about the Kashrus of birds. Now the Torah makes life very easy for us because it lists 24 kinds of birds which are not kosher, and that means that other birds are kosher. What does Rashi say in Chulin? The Ein Of Nechal Lonu Ela B'Masuris Of Shemosru Lonu Avoseinu. Only going by what our forefathers handed down to us, we can eat. But Torah V'Shelo Mosru Lonu, and what they did not hand down to us, Yesh L'Chush, we have a problem. And because, you know, although the Torah lists 24 kinds, and the Mishnah does give characteristics of what the trefa birds are, right? Dores, that means, there are different explanations of what dores means, but the general idea is that it means it's a bird which traps other birds and goes and eats other birds. So dores, it's a bird of prey, right? Then there are other characteristics given about what a kosher bird is. There's the extra toe, which is called the hallux, or a talon, which is a characteristic of the kosher bird, that the skin of the stomach could be stripped off easily. There are characteristics given in the Mishnah, and the Gemara discusses these characteristics. So, nevertheless, we might be getting a translation wrong as to what those non-kosher birds are, which are listed in Parshas Shemini. So we need a Masara, says Rashi. And when we don't have it, that's no good. And he says, Oftar Nechal B'Masores. So the whole kashrus of the birds which you eat are determined by Masara. Where does it say you have to go by Masara? It doesn't. That is the magic of the term. And yet one is called an Abikaris if one denies it. But it's reflected from this Mishnah of Masara generation to generation. It's like in England we have something which we call an unwritten constitution. There are certain traditions to do with the British Parliament, to do with the royal family, which are rules, but they're not written down like some other countries have, a written constitution. Or in Yiddish we have an expression, pasnish, you sometimes hear this expression. That it's not something which is written in writing, but we don't do it. Why? That is our tradition. So you could say, well, it's a slippery slope, people can come with different definitions, maybe it gives an authoritative rather a license to say whatever he wants to say, being machmir. That is not the concern. The concern is that we will follow the tradition as handed down to us. We have guidance on what various rabbonim have said, and that guidance is already from the Rishonim, like what Rashi says with the kashrus of birds.
The Sakim Rebbe says about not living in Eretz Yisrael, right? That become a Masara in the community.
We discussed once a shir called the Three Oaths, and we discussed how he interprets these three oaths, and we showed the arguments against them.
And that's not my point.
That is not what we call Masara.
No, but it might turn out to be Masara because in a few generations' time people won't be able to distinguish.
Well, that may have been...
It's come down five generations, it's Masara.
Well, that may have been his view, but it's a minority view.
It wasn't McCabell by everyone.
It wasn't accepted by the masses. Masara is something which is accepted through the generations by the masses as being our oral tradition. The same can relate to davening. When you're certain texts in the Siddur, can we chop and change them? We think there's a misprint. There's a letter in this week's Jewish Tribune about the davening on Musaf, Shabbos Rosh Chodesh Musaf, Ato Yotzarto. Our Siddurim do not generally contain the phrase, Kachenu b'mitzosecha, v'senchokenu b'sarosecha, v'saminu b'tzuecha, v'samchenu b'shurosecha, v'tayli b'eilu rab d'chaba esfanchenenu, Hashem l'okenu b'avar v'sar Shabbos Kodshecha, v'yonu chuvay Yisrael m'kachay shemecha. Now that's a mouthful. It's in the Nusachari, it's in the Sfadim, but it's not in our Siddurim. The recent editions of Tfilas Kol Peh have restored it. V'yesh Omrim. And years ago, I asked Rabbi Cooper about this. I said, why aren't we saying it? And the Orach HaShulchan writes in Simon Tov Chafhei, in Hilchas Rosh Chodesh, in Sif Beis, that one should say it, and it's a misprint. And when I asked Rabbi Cooper about it, he said, We're not going to start chopping and changing the text handed down to us. It's disrespectful to our previous generations. And his view was, we have a Masorah. And even if you think that the Masorah is wrong, we carry it on. Because that's what's been handed down to us by our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents. That was his view. He says, we don't paskin like Yoruch HaShulchan.
I asked the Rav once about the passage, Ein Shtachavim Heaven, or
oh, yeah.
Which was left out.
Which Rav?
Yeah.
He's Rabbi Dovid Chaim Cohen.
Yes.
And he said that if you've never said it before, you shouldn't start saying it.
Oh, really?
That it was left out, and that was that.
Masorah, that is, it's a respect shown to our previous generations, even if you find a halachic flaw. That is what Masorah is. It is something even stronger than halacha. Yes?
Now, let's be really controversial here.
Oh.
Speak out.
How can we can eat turkey and
pheasant?
Because turkey was right. Near about America.
Okay.
And number two, how come
guinea fowl?
The Nusach Sephard, as opposed to Sephardi, is a later addition. At one point there was only Ashkenaz and Sephardi.
Right. The turkey's on my agenda, so I'll deal with that later. Nusach Ashkenaz Nusach Sephard, I wasn't really going to go down that route, although somebody just last month asked me about doing a subject on Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Sephard. It was you, wasn't it? So we might leave that to another day when I'm not trying to dodge the issue, but the idea is that you do carry on davening the same nusach that's handed down to you from your father, from your father's father. In this very shul, there was a young man, I remember 40 odd years ago, by the name of Yitzchok Katzenberg, who came from a Yekish background and became very Hasidish. He lives in Golders Green, and he wanted to take on Nusach Sfad, so he had a big shiler on his head, because he was adopting the Hasidic tradition. There are poskim who write about this, that Nusach Sfad is regarded as having more Kedusha, it's got the extra tiddly bits in it, and so a person might be allowed to change from Ashkenaz to Sfad, but not the other way around. But the general concept of Masorah is that you do what you were told to do by your previous generations. That is Masorah. And however much you enjoy doing a different nusach or you find it more inspiring, you should do out of respect what your father did, because that is what Masorah is. Yeah, your father had a Masorah. So I once asked the Shaila when I was in yeshiva, look, there are all these different opinions how many hours one waits after meat before you drink milk. So I asked the Shaila in yeshiva, and I was told, do what your father does. And I answered, well, my father's never eaten meat in his life. So I was told, well, in that case, you don't have to do what your father does. And I was told, there are different opinions. You can adopt the 6 hours or the 5 hours and a bit, which is the 6 hour. You can adopt the 3 hours. You can adopt the 1 hour. He said to me, it's up to you. And I said, all right, like a right yok, keeping 1 hour when everybody else was doing 6 hours. So the answer was Masorah. Yes?
But what did your grandfather do?
Ah, well, I had two grandfathers, and they didn't do the same thing. All right, so that's another subject. Yes, my mother's father was from Germany, and my father's father was from Poland. So you can see that. Yes, I'm a hybrid. Right, so we've dealt with Techeles, we've dealt a bit with Tefillah. I'd like to deal a bit with the subject of Kashrus, although it is very wide when it comes to Kashrus. Well, the question is, do we need a Masorah? And we've just quoted from a Rashi who says that you do. The Torah defines kosher animals, chewing the cud, ruminating, splitting the hoof. So we've got the definitions of what a kosher animal is. But are we going to eat animals which we don't have necessarily a Masorah for? Can you go out and eat a giraffe? Now, many people think that the reason why we don't eat a giraffe is because we don't know where to shecht it on its neck, but that's not true. You can shecht it anywhere on its neck. That's not a problem. The problems with giraffes are others, apart from the fact that it's a protected animal, apart from the fact that it can be a very nasty, wild animal. If you start trying to shecht it, it will give you a good kick. It's a very tough meat. People people say it's not easy to eat, and it's very expensive. So those are other ideas, but there is a concern of the Chazon Ish about Masorah, and he says this in relation to the giraffe. Even though it chews the cud, even though it parts the hoof, it's never something which was eaten throughout the generations, so the Chazon Ish was scared to allow it to be introduced, even if you can get hold of it, even if it's not a protected animal. There are people who went into the certain places in Africa where you could perhaps capture it, but we'll come to that in a moment. We've spoken about the kosher birds, and there is an argument in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramot about animals generally. In Yerodei Siman Pei, the Shach says, "Ein onu ata elo ma shekiblu b'masores." So the Shach is emphasizing that you need a Masorah for any animal which you eat, that it is something which was eaten by the Jewish people in former times, that it's handed down. And when it comes to birds, there is the Siman Pei base, two chapters later, in Sif Aleph, and there the Shulchan Aruch says, if the bird has the simonim, which we briefly mentioned earlier, then the bird is okay. However, the Ramah says differently. So, Ein lechol shum of elo b'masores. We don't eat any bird unless we have a masorah for it. Shekibalnu bo shehu tohar, that we've got it. We know it's received by us that it's tohar. V'chein noagin, and that is our practice. V'ein l'shanos. He writes in a very strong way for the Ashkenazim, different than to the Sfardim. Ein l'shanos. You are not allowed to change things. So the question can arise, all right, we know about split hooves and about ruminating. So we know you can eat sheep, cows, goats, and many deers, maybe antelopes. I believe the Federation is planning to bring in venison into this country. Okay, I once had a non-Jewish work colleague who often went to Sweden, and he was talking about all the reindeer there, and somehow in the conversation I mentioned that deer are a kosher animal. So he said, oh, in that case I'll bring some back for you from Sweden. Thank you very much. It then had to go into a half an hour's explanation as to how meat has to be prepared when Jewish people eat it, and that put him off. So what about the zebu animal, which is from India? What about the Asian water buffalo, the African cape buffalo, the bison, the Himalayan yak? They all chew the cud and they part the hoof. So, all right, many will say they're simply variations of the cow in some form. But do we have a masorah for them, or do we need a masorah for them? In 1950, there was an attempt to import to Israel beef from Madagascar, which was the zebu animal, which is a kind of beef, but it's not exactly the same animal. It chews the cud, it parts the hoof, and it originates from India. And Rabbi Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi of Israel, said there was no need for a masorah. We feel that as it's clear cut that it chews the cud and it parts the hoof, we can import it. And the Chazon Ish objected. He said, we want a masorah for it, and we don't have a masorah for the zebu, and therefore he objected strongly. And Rabbi Herzog, in order to keep the peace, he said, okay, we will not proceed. In deference to the Chazon Ish, it was not imported. There was another controversy later in 1990 where animals, because commercially it's much cheaper to bring beef over from South America to Israel, and there are certain animals there which are like the zebu or zebu, which are not just cows. And Rav Eliashiv said, can we please follow the psak of the Chazon Ish? We don't have a clear-cut masorah, and the import was stopped. But there are many rabbonim who will argue that there is no problem with it. And as you mentioned, there is a question about the turkey, because the turkey is not really a chicken, and there was no masorah for it. And where does the turkey originate from? Well, a lot of people assumed that the turkey was coming from India, and there were lots of Jews for a very long time, over a very long period, who were eating the turkey. The truth is, though, it originated from what they call the New World, from America. And you can't claim a masorah from something which was discovered only in 1492. Do we call that a masorah or not? So there is a lot written about this. The Netziv wrote in the Meshiv Dovar, in his Shuvas, in Yerodei Siman Chof Beis, that if something is already assumed to have been okay, then that is already continued to be okay. So he interpreted Masorah not simply as something which comes from Moshe Rabbeinu, but if Jews have been doing it already for a while, for a long time, then it becomes established like a Chazokah, and we can call that a Masorah. But not everybody agrees with it. Sorry. In 1832, Rav Yitzchok ben Meir HaKohen from Livorno, Italy, wrote a sefer called Zivchei Kohen, and he listed 30 birds which have a Masorah. It included the pheasant, the peacock, the quail, the mallard, the dove, the robin, which was recently voted as the bird of Britain, but he omitted from his list the turkey, and that was as recent ago as 1832. So the Balamora writes, and he was a long time ago, that any bird which has a wide beak and webbed feet, such as the goose, you can regard as not being a dores, which is like a bird of prey, and that is the main criterion to follow, and therefore you can regard it as kosher.
The robin is a bird of prey.
Well, kosher birds do eat worms.
Yeah.
Even though the worms are not kosher. The Divrei Aharon writes in his Sefer that just because you get small differences between different kinds of birds, it does not create a new halachic species. And from there, some rabbonim derive that the turkey is a kind of chicken. So the Shalas Shuvas Beis Ovi, which is more recent, writes in his third Chelek, Simon Samach, and a few other chapters beyond, he said, if it looks like a chicken, if it walks like a chicken, and if it quacks like a chicken, then it is a chicken. And he was writing in connection with rock Cornish hens, which are not really chickens. So anyway, the number of poskim, classic poskim, from the 16th century, 17th century, the Shoel Umeshiv, Rav Nosson Adler, the Devar Moshe, they all allowed turkey on the basis that it was allowed with Masorah, some sort of Masorah. But there were others who argued against it. And Rav Yitzchok Shmelkus, the Beis Yitzchok, who was the very first posek who wrote about electricity, he forbade them, he forbade turkeys. The Wurzburger Rav, who my grandparents were distantly related to, Rav Yitzchok Dov Halevi Bamberger, did not allow turkey, and neither did Rav Yaakov Etlinger, the Oruch Lener, and Rav Shlomo Kluger as well. But the Schutz Beis Meir writes in Simen Yotess, nowadays we eat turkey based on the Jews of India who ate it for centuries. So we can call that a Masorah. The Kaf HaChaim says it's okay in Simon Pei Beis. The Arugas HaBosim, he says you really only need a Masorah with a bird when there is doubt about the dores status. And like we quoted with the Nativ above, the Nativ said, if it's already assumed to be okay, then it is okay. And I believe that all the major kashrut organizations give a heksha to turkey, including the Badats, including even Kadassia. We do get heksherim on it. So, do we need Masorah for animals? Rav Vozna in his Sheva HaLevi expressed doubt with the Chazon Ish's view that you really need a Masorah for every single animal. He said if it chews the cud and parts the hoof, for sure, then you will know that it's kosher. But he wanted to defer and respect the view of the Chazon Ish. So he said in Eretz Yisrael we will continue the tradition of the Chazon Ish. We keep to the Masorah, but in Chutz Laaretz we might be more flexible and use these criteria. So he was basically saying that a buffalo burger would be okay.
You get kosher buffalo in America.
You can get kosher buffalo, although the buffalo, what they call their buffalo, is really the bison. Yes.
The crucial question you have to ask on that Chazon Ish is, right, so let's say you're living in Madagascar.
Yes.
You've got a minion and a kahila there.
Yes.
The only behema that is available is this zevon. That is the only kosher behema on the island. Right. Surely, I mean, you can't say that you're going to go contrary against a famous possible Torah that says it's got Coven who chooses the card. That's kosher.
But if there's nothing else to eat, the halacha is not determined by the fact that you've only got that animal and nothing else. You know, if Masorah, according to Chazon Ish, if Masorah dictates that we haven't got a tradition for it, then be a vegetarian in Madagascar. You need Masorah, and it's not determined by the fact that that's the only thing there is to eat and there is nothing else. I'm sure there are fish in Madagascar.
But effectively, the Hashiva that was applied to Turkey is the same logic that I've just applied to Madagascar. Jews went to North America, they started eating the turkey. It started being imported to Europe. Jews in Europe started eating it.
Well,
same
okay. From that suck of Rav Vozna in the Shevet Halevi, it's Chutz Laaretz. He writes this in his Chelek Yud, Simon Kuf Yud Dalad. According to him, then you can eat it. because it fulfills the criteria of splitting the hoof, chewing the cud, and even if you haven't got a strong masora, chutz laretz, according to him, it's okay. And there are others who will say, we want a masora. We want to be 100% sure. And masora is something which is so strong, but you don't find it so strong in kashrus like you do in some other things. Because we had this machlokas between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama about the Sarah, remember, with the birds. So it's not so clear cut. The Sfadim and the Ashkenazim do have a different route. But in certain other things, like what we're coming to next, Masara seems to be even stronger. Going to be a bit controversial, I'm afraid, and I'll try not to get myself into hot water by bringing up the subject of feminism and the role of women, of course, in Jewish law. Somebody once asked me to do a shir about women and davening and women's minyonim and women being called up to the Sefer Torah, and being a bit of a coward, I was very scared. But but there are there are issues relating to Masora where you do not get clear-cut written halacha saying that something is not in order or something is in order. Mm-hmm. Now, we are in a day and age where women have progressed to not only be as good as men in many jobs, but even better than men in many jobs. And you've got women professors in this country, and you've got women judges in this country, and it would be very wrong to demean them, to suggest in any way that they're inferior. There was this recent professor who resigned his post because he said men and women shouldn't work in the same laboratory because, well, they fall in love with each other, and the women cry when they're told off, but he wasn't saying the same thing. But you've got top eminent women scientists. My son in the Menorah Grammar School had a friend who did very well in his Gemara homework. So the teacher asked him, did you get help from your father? And he said, no. He said, well, I'm sorry, but the way you've done this homework is really, really good. You must have had some help. He said, yes, I got help from my mother. She's got a degree in Talmudics. So the teacher got a bit of a shock.
Last year, before he came to England, and I was learning to understand, so his mother used to help him with his Gemara homework sometimes.
Yeah. And the Gemara talks about that Rabbi Meir was out collecting for his yeshiva. His wife Beruya gave the shir to the Talmidim in the yeshiva, albeit from behind the mechitza, but she gave the shir. And nowadays there are some women who are well known on the international scene who give a lot of inspiration. A number of times I've been to hear and watch Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis, who I may have quoted a few times. She's very inspiring, and she has brought thousands of people into Yiddishkeit. There are other women who are well known, Rebbetzin Schlesinger, who is now unwell, but who have inspired hundreds and hundreds of people. So we cannot sort of just turn around and try and suppress the feminist movement to say women are inferior, women have to stay at home, women are less important than men. That's not what we're saying. But we do have certain masoras about the idea of what the roles are of men and what the roles are of women. Women don't have duties relating to the mitzvahs of seishas mangaroma, mitzvahs which have a specific time aspect to them, which are the positive commandments. So they have to keep Shabbos, because Shabbos is also a lo saseh. It's also a negative commandment. So that ties up with the aseh. But women don't have to keep sukkah. Men have different roles. Rav Hirsch explains that women don't need as many mitzvahs as men do, because they can reach a higher spiritual level without all the mitzvahs that the men have to do. Men have to daven regularly three times a day. Women have to daven, but they're not tied up. So there are different roles. So when it comes, for example, to the subject of women saying Kaddish, and I once walked into a frum shul in Chicago on the weekday minyan, and the mechitza was up, and there were women behind the mechitza. Wow, amazing, on a weekday. And I heard them saying Kaddish. There are women who are doing this, and they feel emotionally that it's going to help the departed. But if you don't have a duty to say Kaddish, or if you can't make other people yotza with your Kaddish, then has your Kaddish got any value? My own grandmother, when she was 12 years old, and she was the oldest of 8 children, and she only had one brother who was very small, her father died at the young age of 35, and at the United Synagogue Beis Olam, she was told to say Kaddish. But the Poskim nowadays are saying, look, if you're not duty bound to say Kaddish, or if you can't make other people yotza with your Kaddish, then is it going to have any value? And the Svei Chemed says, it's a Dovah Chodosh, it's a new innovation. This is what we mean by modernity coming against the Masorah. He says, it's Dovah Chodosh Razor. He says, no way did we ever have this in the past, and therefore it's not to be done. He says, women can do something for their close departed, rather than saying Kaddish, when they do good deeds, that is helping the Shomus, that is helping the departed. Are they really helping the departed with something which they have no duty for? So that's the question which comes up. And the question, of course, is with women of the war.
Can I ask the question?
Yes.
Why is it that with men it does help? I mean, why should it help? Why should say Kaddish help from the Shomer, right? Only for men. In other words, it's not really a time-bound thing. It's linked to the davening. The davening is linked to time, but it's not really. Kaddish is not really. It's just so
well,
why shouldn't they have?
This is what
I'm
saying.
Why shouldn't they have? Okay, they may not be able to be yoked. I have a problem being a Yotzer men for various brothers. It's not really a brother.
I knew I was entering hot territory today, but we can have a full shiur just about Kaddish. We did once have a shiur about yacht sites when we spoke about the benefits of Kaddish, in that it does have benefits for the departed. But we have the Masorah, and as we were saying, Masorah is stronger, in fact, than what you might try to define in Halacha.
Because women didn't go to shul.
We never had a Masorah.
Because they're supposed to be at home looking after the children, so therefore they never said Kaddish.
Well, that's not what the Vilna Gaon says. The Vilna Gaon says they don't have a duty to go to shul, and if they come to shul, they'll be jealous of the other ladies' dresses, and they'll be starting rechilas, and so he is worried about women coming to shul, but women are perfectly allowed to come to shul. And it's wonderful if they get a spiritual uplift from it. But they don't have the duty to sit in the sukkah, they don't have the duty to come to shul, they don't have a duty to do these various other mitzvahs, like, all right, shofar kiblu al atzmon, Megillah they have to keep because they went the same miracle. Abba Kosas Matzah on Seder night they have to keep, because of the righteous women we came out from Egypt, they get a lot of zechus. But if they don't have a duty, I'm not saying they have to stay at home and change the nappies, they can get a nanny to do that, they can come to shul, they can feel spiritually uplifted. But the question is, if there is no Masorah, and if we do have the tradition of Kol Kavoda Bas Melech Panimo of Tzinius, that women are not playing a frontline role, and that is not to suppress them, it's not because it's a male-dominated society, as they will accuse us of, it's simply because the idea is that because they are a distraction to men, it's a compliment to them, because they're attractive to men, therefore they will take a lesser role in public affairs.
If men are saying Kaddish, and they in an undertone say Kaddish, and you don't really hear them, but they feel that they're doing their bit, if you like, because they feel that the way...
Well, there is a halakhic question.
Why shouldn't they be able to
say? Well, is it effective? There are rabbonim, as you say, who will allow it.
Even on the union.
Really? Yep. Even on the union? Name them.
Rabbi Shmuel for one.
All right. Okay.
Can I
was quoting from something which was called out once in the House of Commons. Okay. We're just trying to understand what the idea of Masorah is. I know that this is a controversial topic, and there are other aspects relating to women's feelings or rights or duties which other people argue about as well. But let us start off with Masorah. Let us quote what our Rabbonim are saying. The Svei Chemed, it's a Dovah Chodosh. It's a new thing. Now, if somebody says Kaddish quietly, it's a question whether it's effective, because the whole idea of Kaddish is not what you say, it's what you're provoking people to say. You are provoking people to say Omein Yehi Shmei Rabba, and that is the Kiddush Hashem which results from Kaddish. So if you say Kaddish quietly, I'm not sure if it's going to help anyway. Right, that's the other thing.
Can I just ask, we were talking about Masorah with meat, with turkey.
Yes.
Does the same thing exist with fish? Animals that live in the sea.
Question. We do have the tradition of fins and scales, but we do not have such a strong word, Masorah, but there are questions relating to certain fish. I don't think I'm going to have a lot of time talking about this article. Basically, there are two individuals called Ari Zivotofsky and Ari Greenspan who decided that if we don't keep up eating these animals which are kosher, which we know to be kosher, then the Masorah will be lost. And therefore, what they've devised is every year to make a Masorah dinner and to have an 18-course meal. I don't know how you could cope with this. And between each course, they have a shear about the animal which they've been eating or were about to eat. Just to, and one of the things they talk about is the swordfish. And look at the picture on the front of this Mishpacha article about catching a swordfish. And the problem with the swordfish was not that it has got fins and scales, but the scales seem to wear off very easily shortly after it's been caught. So it's a kosher fish. They claim that it's okay and so on. And they did this with a heksha of the Chicago Rabbinical Council. Rav Schwartz, I once met, is an amazing Talmid Chacham, very reliable. And they have been doing now this 18-course dinner. And they've been having a menu with sparrow broth, cow udder, water buffalo, and fried locusts, attracting a surprising amount of media attention, no doubt. They point out that with modern commercial food production, things are different to, say, 100 years ago when you had the shochet around the corner. You took your chicken to the shochet, you took any animal to the shochet, and it wasn't based on animals which are commercially viable. So what's happening nowadays is that when you go into the local butcher shop, they are selling you stuff which they can make profit from, which is commercially viable. And if they start having bison and whatever, locusts or sparrow broth, they won't sell so easily, given the conservative nature of the British, small c of course. So they're worried that this would be lost. And the old Shochim and rabbis who recognized the wild birds living in their communities in Germany, in the Yemen, in Kurdistan, North Africa, and other far-flung Jewish communities were fast disappearing. And so they've devised this Masorah Seuda to have every year to keep up this tradition. So there are various fish which they discuss. There's the swordfish, and they actually quote Poskim who talk about the fish which has like a cherev as its mouth, the sword as its mouth, which show that it's kosher. There's the king clip from South Africa. It's got cycloid scales which are small, thin, and covered by very tiny membrane. The South African basin allowed this fish for the last 50 years. Ask any South African, they'll tell you it's delicious and a staple in their diet. But senior Poskim and Estrad expressed doubts. They were worried about it. So although the South African rabbinical authorities still list it as kosher, you won't get it in Israel or in London. So there's the shivusa fish. The Gemara says it tastes just like pork. And you can eat this, and you can... Chazal had a Masora. They had it handed down to them. It tastes like the pig, and that this is a kosher fish. So they went out their way to find out where the shivuta is. Problem is, it's in Iraq, Iran, or Euphrates, and they're not that friendly, maybe, when you say to them, listen, I need to have a Jewish diet. But this is disgusting. If you want a copy of this article, you can have it. Talks about the buffalo, where it roams, the kosher deer, what is utterly ridiculous. Talks about kosher eggs. How many different kinds of kosher eggs have you eaten? Very interesting article, all based on the idea of Masorah. And they're not two quacks. They've done this with rabbinical guidance. So there you have it, a very fascinating subject. Back, of course, to the women. We haven't got much time. I know that even more controversial than the idea of women's minyanim and women leining, women kaddish, are the bas mitzvahs which might take place. And how can you have it? Where can you have it? When can you have it? Do it? Not controversial. Okay, then we'll leave it. I didn't ask anything to the Rav, but he must have had an intuition that, well, I might mention it because I was talking about the subject of Masorah modernity, and he came up to me and discussed it with me after Shachris. But basically, there are different sources which speak about the idea of how to celebrate Bas Mitzvah whilst keeping up the tradition of Tzinius and not allowing modernity. Many accused it as being a reform innovation, as creeping into the Orthodox world, and therefore it should be resisted. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes about it in the Igros Moshe, Eich Arachaim, Chelek Aleph, Simon Kostalud, that it's a new innovation, but he didn't see any problem with it in taking place in the family setting where the girl can make a speech and get inspiration from it in realizing what her duties are. There was a different approach taken by the 3-day Eish in his Truvas in Chelek Gimel, Simon Sadi Gimel. He says, well, we don't bow down in shul because goyim bow down in church. So we're not bringing in a church innovation when we bow down in shul. And he said, okay, you're not going to do a bas mitzvah in the shul, but if you have certain limited celebrations in the house, or if it's even in the shul hall, he's for no reason for it if it inspires our daughters, provided he said that there's no machlokas. So there you have it. And I think the message which came to me most when I looked at this subject was ringing in my ears was the words of Rabbi Cooper Zeched Tzadik Livracha, who was our Rav here many, many years. And just like with the subject of tefillah, so with other things as well. He says, we're not going to go against what our previous generations handed down to us because we will show them respect. It's like a kibbut of the aim. It's kibbut for the Rav. Those are halachas. And we will show respect to them. Even if we think, genuinely believe, that they might have made a mistake, we have a Masorah, and we will continue the path which our previous generation set for us, because that is the way that Yiddishkeit will survive, more than anything else, by keeping strongly with that conviction and that attitude that what is handed down to us is Moshe Emes for Saroso Emes, just like we said in the first Mishnah. That Masorah is what keeps us going strongly, and to define new innovations which are a threat to the slippery slopes, as they call it, which can erode the traditions handed down. Thank you very much.